This is Barry Tyker. Today is February 4th. I'm in room 150 Bascom with the Provost, John Wiley, and we're going to continue our interview that we started on December 30th of last year. Today we're going to talk about the materials science program. When John Bollinger was named dean, I was talking to Max Legale, and he noted that you and he had a white paper on the dean's desk the first day relating to the Materials Science Center. Why did you feel inclined to put together that white paper, and what was it about?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I should back up just a little bit, and this is a particularly good place to sort of set the record straight on a couple of points.
Okay.
Over the last few years since I've been involved in central campus positions, somehow or other, certain phrases have gotten into all the press releases or descriptions of my background here, and they refer to me as sometimes the founder of the material science program, or the father of material science on campus, or an architect of material science. In my opinion, none of that is true. I've never been able to get it corrected or stated correctly, but there has been a material science program, graduate level interdepartmental degree program on this campus since, I believe, about 1968. I don't remember the exact year when it started. But some of the people who were involved in literally founding it, starting it, were Arthur Dodd, Jim Kautsky, Jim Nordman, John Ferry from the chemistry department, and probably others that I can't remember just quickly here. And what they did was they observed that there was a need for a program that could attract students who, primarily students who had a background, an undergraduate background in physics and chemistry and other basic sciences, but who wanted to apply that to graduate level study of the properties of modern materials, semiconductors, metals, alloys of metals, plastics, polymers of various sorts, and so on, composite materials. And so they proposed and got the university and the regents to agree to establish this interdepartmental degree program, which was to be a little bit unusual in the sense that it was not part of a department, a normal academic department. It was interdepartmental. Mm-hmm. And therefore, an advisory committee was formed, sort of a self-selected advisory committee. People who were interested in this volunteered to be a part of it, and they elected a chair. The chair functioned more or less as a department chair, except it was not a department, it was a committee degree.
So it didn't have a budget or anything like that?
No, not really. Initially it had almost nothing. Gradually the College of Engineering provided more and more resources, a part-time secretary, eventually a full-time secretary, half of the salary of the chair. Mm-hmm. And gradually over the years, the faculty who were involved were quite successful in getting equipment grants and building up an actual service center associated with it, which was called the Material Science Center, distinct from the Material Science Program. Mm-hmm. And whoever was chairing the program was also dubbed the director of the center.
Oh, okay.
And that center then eventually managed to convince the college to hire one technician and then another, until at one point, and maybe still today, they have, I believe, three technicians who help maintain the equipment and teach students how to use it and so on. So that's the background. Now, that started in 68. I came to campus as a faculty member in 75, and I don't remember the exact year that I was arm-twisted into being the chair of material science. I think it was about 78 or 9, maybe. So I was not the architect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it is true, however, and I take some pride in this, that during the time that I was chair, I put a lot of time and effort into building the program up, increasing the number of students, getting additional technicians. Some of that growth from zero to three technicians occurred when I was chair. Haranguing faculty to spend more time, devoting more time and energy to the program itself, writing more equipment grants, and so on. Now, to answer your question, Max Legale, David Larbalestier, and I spent the better part of one summer thinking about the future of that program, meeting regularly for lunch, sometimes meeting through the morning and through lunch, or after lunch through the afternoon, and just brainstorming where the program was headed, where it should be headed, what was needed, and so on. We developed a strategic plan for the program. When we realized that we were in the middle of a dean search and that the next dean of engineering was going to be critically important in helping decide whether or not we could implement our plans, we devised a strategy that on day one, when the new dean, whoever that might be, stepped into the office, we would appear with a plan to slap down on his desk and tell him that here's an early success for you in your new deanship. We've got it all worked out for you. All you've got to do is say yes to this, which is what we did. And he actually liked the plan and said yes to most of it.
What were the major points in the plan?
Building up the staff, allocating more space in the engineering research building, of the things we wanted from the dean. There were a number of other aspects to the plan, though, that had to do with the curriculum, how we recruited students, how the program should be organized, what kinds of equipment we would need in the future that we didn't have at the time, that sort of thing.
And you found the dean you're talking about is John Bollinger,
right,
of course, and he was receptive to all of
this?
Yeah,
he was. He was. I think he counted the material science program as, in many respects, a model for other programs of its kind in the future.
Had he had any contact with it before, other than just knowing that it existed?
No, he had not.
He had not been involved in it at all?
No, he was never on the faculty advisory committee. And
so you were chairman at this point. Once you got the dean's ear on this and he started to give you some of what you needed, how did you go about developing the program? What were some of the building blocks that you...
I think the most important aspect of it was that we recruited really good students. And so the faculty who were part of the program were keen on getting some of these students into their research groups. And the reason they were willing to devote time and effort to the program was access to those students. We also, during that time, developed an industrial consortium, of which there weren't very many back in those days. It was an unusual sort of thing. And what that means is Max and Dave and I and others went out around the country talking to companies that hired our graduates and telling them that if they gave us some amount of money per year, I think the amount was $10,000 in those days, we would offer them the following advantages or benefits, and they would just feel wonderful about supporting such a fine program.
Like what kind of benefits would you offer someone?
Not much. We had an annual meeting at which there was a formal program, and it was by invitation only. So if you weren't contributing, or someone we were trying to recruit as a contributor, you didn't know about it and couldn't attend. And at those annual meetings, we gave pretty in-depth updates on recent late-breaking developments in material science and made sure that they met all the students so that they would have a chance to recruit them if they wanted to, and things of that sort.
And these were fairly successful.
Oh yeah, very successful. We got, I think at the peak we had at least 8 or 10 paying companies. Now some of them didn't give us cash. Some had company policies against it, and so they gave us equipment instead. For example, Tektronix Corporation, which makes oscilloscopes and things, I don't believe ever gave us cash, but each year they would send us their catalog and say, pick what you want up to a dollar value of X. And so we would get free equipment from them. And 3M and Honeywell and other companies actually did pay cash, send us checks every year.
So when I was over and taking a tour of the engineering College of Engineering earlier this year, I saw a lot of little postings of different industries that were supporting these different research groups. Are those sort of latter-day versions of these industrial consortiums?
In some cases, yeah. I suspect that what you saw were things from other consortia. Don Novotny had his consortium called WEMPEC, the Wisconsin Electric Machines and Power Electronics Consortium, was the prototype that we copied. We wanted to develop something like that in material science.
What about federal funding, National Science Foundation, anything like that?
We regularly got equipment grants from the NSF. The individual faculty who were members of the advisory committee got research grants, but we rarely got group research grants. as a center or as a program.
So these individual programs that were already in existence were given more substance through the material science. Were there any programs that were started by the materials science program per se?
Well, there are quite a number that were spin-offs in the sense that the materials science program brought people together, and as one of the consequences of their meeting together regularly and cooperating in that program, they devised and implemented other centers or programs. So, for example, the Thin Film Deposition Center, I would say, is a spin-off of materials science. The Plasma Aided Manufacturing Center, in many respects, was. The Center for X-ray Lithography was. I could probably think of others. Well, there were quite a few that were developed as a result of interactions in the materials science program.
Now, you mentioned that this was a 50% appointment. Did this take up 50% of your time?
Yeah, it took about 40 hours a week.
Okay. I was going to say, this sounds like a little more than a 50% appointment. Were you continuing to teach?
Yes, continued to teach and do research throughout that period.
And you remained there until, when was it, 1985, 86?
If you say
when you
I don't remember these dates.
Okay. Who succeeded you?
As the chair of material science? Jim Taylor in chemistry.
Oh, Jim Taylor. Mm-hmm.
Ah. Right.
And the program is, it's pretty much followed the direction as far as you know? That
pretty
you
much, yeah. There's recently, there's been a review in engineering, and I have to tell you that I haven't, I've had to be a little careful early on to not interfere with the program. After I left it, I had to let the next director and the faculty advisory committee do what they thought best. But there has recently been a review of the program conducted by the College of Engineering, and I don't know the outcome of that. But it could result in a merger of that program with the Department of Material Science and Engineering, because now there is a formal department of Material Science.
Oh, I see.
And there didn't used to be.
When did the department first get formed?
4 or 5 years ago, I guess. It's the old Department of Metallurgical Engineering.
Oh, M&M.
Yeah, M&ME.
Way, way back.
That's right. That department has had many names over the years.
Yeah.
It was once, way back, it was the Department of Metallurgy, I think. Then it was Metallurgical and Mining Engineering.
Yeah.
Then it was Metallurgical and Mineral Engineering. And then most recently, they changed their name to Material Science and Engineering.
Oh. Is that the one that Max is in?
Yes.
He's changed his... I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Is there anything else... you're familiar with other engineering programs, I'm sure. Are there other engineering programs in the Midwest or that you're familiar with that have a program something like the material science program?
Oh, yeah. There are quite a few. Now, in many cases... Well, let me be clear on that. There are lots of universities in the Midwest who have material science degree programs. In some cases, they are material science departments with degree programs in them, and in relatively fewer cases, they're interdepartmental programs like ours.
Okay.
But as a matter of fact, I think about 40 to 45% of all of the material science degrees in the country are granted by universities in the upper Midwest.
Oh, why is that?
The Great Lakes states. It's just historically been a sort of a hotbed of research in this area. Some of it traces to the importance of the steel industry and mineral-intensive industries at the turn of the century.
Yeah. Okay.
So we had a lot of strong departments in those areas. It's just a fact that not many people realize. We generate an awful lot of material scientists in the Midwest who end up working on the coasts.
Well, I think I finally got the materials center and the program and everything else sorted out. So, I understand that you were involved with Semitech effort. Could you explain how you got involved in that?
Sure. Semitech stands for Semiconductor Manufacturing Technology. It's the name of a consortium of electronics companies, all the biggies: IBM, Hewlett Packard, Intel, and so on. It was formed. Gee, I don't even remember exactly how many years ago, at least 10 years ago, I think, in response to fears that the U.S. electronics industry was losing its competitive edge, primarily to the Japanese, but more generally to the Pacific Rim countries. and that there was a need to do something to enhance U.S. competitiveness. So this consortium was formed, and they decided that they would build a facility, a model manufacturing facility somewhere in the country. And they announced that and said, we're open to suggestions from any communities in the country, or proposals from you, why we should locate in your area. Governor Thompson decided that we should compete for that, that Wisconsin should compete for it. And so he asked the Department of Development to do something about putting a proposal together, and there was no one in the Department of Development who knew anything about semiconductors or microelectronics. So they asked us, they asked the university, UW-Madison.
Before we get to you, was there any reason, did you find out if there was a reason why Governor Thompson was particularly attracted to this?
Sure, he was. He had a lot of interest and was getting a lot of credit and putting a lot of his political hopes on economic development of the state. And he was interested in attracting new companies, new jobs to Wisconsin.
Okay. So he came to the university, or his...
So he asked us to help put together a proposal to get them here. Now, I don't remember the exact route of the phone calls, but calls came to campus, probably to the chancellor's office, then to the grad school, then to engineering. Eventually, it landed on my desk.
Lucky you.
Partly because of material science, also partly because of my department, electrical and computer engineering, mm-hmm. and partly because I had more or less recently come to the university from the electronics industry. I guess people mm-hmm. thought I might know something about Semitech's business and what it would take to get them here. Well, I thought I did, as a matter of fact, and I discussed it with a few of my colleagues, like Henry Guckel and others, and we thought it was a lost cause. We thought that the people who were involved in forming Semitech probably knew already where they wanted to locate, and that it would probably be in Silicon Valley or Route 128 in the Boston area, or some existing high-tech corridor of that sort, and that it would be a foolish waste of time for us to try to put together a proposal and bring them to the frozen northland.
Cold tundra Wisconsin. Yeah.
Where there isn't, frankly, very much concentration of electronics manufacturing right now. So, but on the other hand, we didn't want to be the ones to tell the governor, no, we can't do that. So what we did was we suggested hiring a consultant, and I knew someone who I thought was very credible and would really know and was an insider in the electronics industry, and that he would come here and look us over and say, don't bother, you're wasting mm-hmm. your time. So we hired him.
Who was he?
His name was Bob McIntosh. And he came here and spent a couple of days with us, reading over the Semitech call for proposals and hearing our ideas. Oh, by the way, I should have mentioned that the Department of Development and the governor did appoint a committee to lead this effort, and it was chaired by Jim Carley.
Hmm. Oh yes, Carley. Okay.
So we all met with Bob McIntosh, Jim Carley, and some of his staff, and Rolf Wigenke for the Department of Development, Henry Guckel, Jim Taylor, myself, and we batted it around for a day or two, and Bob ended up concluding not only could we do it, but we would be quite competitive.
Mm.
Because there were some unique things here that they simply couldn't find elsewhere.
Were you happy to hear that?
By the end, I guess he had us convinced, so we were, yeah. But it certainly wasn't what we expected.
Hmm.
It does show that we're willing to change our minds.
Yes, it does.
Anyway, it was also kind of late in the game.
Mm-hmm.
The proposals were due rather shortly after that. So we put together a proposal in absolutely record time. I think it was 1 week, meaning 7 days, start to finish.
Oh my God.
From deciding to do it to having a finished, printed, full-color, professional brochure to send them. So we literally worked around the clock. My wife was one of the technical writers who mm-hmm. helped write the text, and We were all involved in cutting and pasting and selecting pictures and figures and making graphs. And
did anyone head it up, or were you just sort of a group doing
this? I was just a group, I think.
Okay.
Bob McIntosh was the glue in many ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, we kept him on then.
Oh, you did. Okay.
As a consultant in the proposal preparation process. But we all contributed, more or less equally, I think. We're surprised to then be among the finalists. I think it was five of the sites that were selected for site visits.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't remember what they all were. There was Austin, Texas, Phoenix, Arizona, something in California, and I don't remember where, Madison, and one other, and I don't remember where that one was either. Oh, I think there was one in New Mexico that involved Sandia Labs. So that was what happened. We actually, before the site visit to Madison, we had to go on an inverse site visit. We were all asked to come out to somewhere in California, Sunnyvale, I think, and make an oral presentation of our proposal. So we actually made two cuts. First cut was maybe there were 10 or so people invited to come out there and make that, and then they narrowed it down to five.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually sent teams around to visit the five potential sites. And in the end, we were the second choice.
Mm.
Austin, Texas was their first choice, and Madison was second.
Mm.
So we did pretty well, but we didn't get Sematech here.
Now, I remember reading somewhere, or somebody perhaps told me, maybe it was Clayton, that Les Aspin and Bob Kastenmeyer became involved.
Well, they were involved in a way. They endorsed having it in Wisconsin and so on, and they were both well-respected and well-placed in Congress. Les Aspin was the chair of the Armed Services Committee, and Bob Kastenmeyer was quite well-known in the electronics industry and highly respected because he was an expert on intellectual property, patents and copyrights and related things. And he was the one who wrote the legislation that the electronics industry desperately wanted and needed to enable them to copyright the patterns on masks that are used to make integrated circuits.
Did Donna Shalala and Ken Shaw play any role in the effort?
I think in one way or another, almost everyone was involved. When they were here in Madison for their site visit, of course, all of the local dignitaries were brought out. We made a videotape. Some local company, I'm just remembering this now as we discuss it. I can't remember what company it was, but a local video company volunteered their time, and they hired an airplane and did some video shots of Madison and of the site we were proposing, which was in the research park. And one vignette that I remember was sort of a day in the life of Madison. It showed then Mayor Sensenbrenner opening his door in the morning and reaching down and picking up his newspaper and opening it up, and on the headline it said, Sematech picks Madison. that was on the video that we showed them. They were quite amused. Then when they came here, they were hosted. There was a very nice luncheon in the governor's mansion. The governor was part of the site visit, the mayor, the county exec, the president of the system, the chancellor, everyone was involved.
What did they tell? Did they say why Texas was picked over
you? Yeah, the make or break issue that made the difference in this case was that Texas had an existing building sitting vacant, already ready to be occupied, that they could move into. And our proposal said that there is no such suitable place in Madison. We will build you a building to your specifications, and we'll do it in 6 months. And they said, we can't wait 6 months.
Oh, boy.
That was it.
But later on, UW was named a center of excellence.
Right. They have subsequently, ever since then, they've funded our program in X-ray lithography. Mm-hmm. And it's, I'll say this without any, well, with some prejudice because I helped found it, but without any embarrassment, I can say that it's unique in the country. It's the very best university-based program in X-ray lithography, and almost the only one. There's one at MIT, there's a small one at Stanford, and a few other little efforts here and there, but this one is head and shoulders above all the others.
Now, when it was first started, the center, It was to develop the technology that used X-rays to etch computer chips. Is that?
Yeah, it uses X-rays to expose the patterns. The X-rays themselves don't do the etching, but they do. Modify light-sensitive materials in such a way that they can be etched to produce the patterns that make the computer chips. Yeah.
So we have kept our end of the bargain, and they've been giving us, they gave us, what, $1 million a year for 5 years or something like that?
It's been actually a lot more than that, because they have, almost in every year that we've had it, there have been add-ons to the budget for various specific things. You'd have to talk to Franco Serena, who's the director of the center, to get an accurate reckoning of the total amount, I'm sure the average amount over the time that it's been in existence has been way over $1 million a year. There have been years in which they had up to $10 million.
Wow.
From various sources.
Now, I know that Wharf gave them some money early on, $1.5 million or something like that. Back in 83.
That got them launched.
Who were some of the other people who gave that, who gave the amounts that would add up to $10 million a year?
Oh, IBM, National Semiconductor, Honeywell, through equipment donations, Hewlett-Packard, Carl Zeiss, the Italian government, the Department of Defense, ARPA, Semitech, the Semiconductor Research Corporation. Did I say Motorola?
No.
Motorola. Lots of
gotta
sources.
Ask, why did the Italian
NSF?
Government? Oh, why did the Italian government give money?
Well, now that's an interesting story. The Italian government has contracted with us for a number of things related to X-ray optics and synchrotron radiation and so on. But what I had in mind when I mentioned the Italian government was a very interesting story, and I'm glad to put this on the record. There are a set of regulations that the Defense Department promulgates called ITAR, International Traffic in Arms Regulations, that prohibit the export of certain critical technologies. It's not just arms, but all sorts of know-how and technology associated with things like cryptography and chip making, electronics. And partly as a result of that, and partly for international trade protectionist reasons and so on, they forbid us to use, they wanted us to buy a big expensive piece of equipment called a stepper. It's the thing that aligns a mask and a silicon wafer very, very accurately so that you can expose the X-rays through the mask with an extraordinary degree of accuracy. I mean, accuracy that's the equivalent of a human hair's width out of a mile, something like that, okay?
That's accurate.
It is very, very accurate. It's beyond imagination. But these are expensive pieces of equipment, and the best one in the world and the only one that we wanted to have was made by a German company. And they refused to allow us to buy that because it was not U.S. manufactured. Instead, they told us they would have PerkinElmer Corporation make it. Does PerkinElmer ring a bell? That's the company that made the malfunctioning part on the Hubble Space Telescope.
Oh, yes.
Well, so we went out to Connecticut, where PerkinElmer has planned, and we talked to their engineers, and we saw their designs, and we were absolutely convinced that what they were planning to do wouldn't work. And furthermore, that they wouldn't get it done on time, and they sure wouldn't get it done on budget, and that it would be a waste of time and effort for us to wait for them to have it done, because it was never going to happen. And I can say that very comfortably now, because everything I just said turned out to be true. They had, over the years, mammoth cost overruns, and they eventually went bankrupt, and they never did get a working device delivered after burning $20, $30, $40 million of Defense Department money. I have no idea how much they really milked on this. But meantime, we decided, well, that's a dead end, but we really need the stepper. How are we going to get one? Turns out the Italians had bought a German stepper, and they were sitting on it because they didn't have any way of using it. They didn't have a synchrotron light source up and running that they needed to make use of their stepper. So we negotiated, Franco Serina negotiated with the Italians to loan us that stepper. So although it was illegal for us to spend federal money to buy it, there wasn't anything the federal government could do to prevent us from borrowing one. Hmm. So they shipped it over here and we installed it and got it up and running, and U.S. companies flocked to it. It was a unique resource for a couple of years. In fact, as it turns out, we still have it, because by the time the Italians got their synchrotron ready to use it, they considered it to be an obsolete piece of equipment, and so they bought a newer.
Is most work done at the synchrotron reading?
Most of the X-ray lithography work is done out at what we now call the Kaganza Research Campus. It's the Synchrotron Radiation Center and Physical Sciences Lab, mm-hmm. and there are about six or eight very large house trailers set up, mm-hmm. which are the offices of the X-ray Lithography Center.
Yeah.
And then the synchrotron itself is where the equipment is.
Yeah, Dave Huber took me for a tour of that. It's really quite impressive.
Yes, it is.
You mentioned the name Franco Serina.
Serina. Mm-hmm.
How long has he been director of the...
Almost for its entire history. The first director, the people who founded the center were Henry Gokel, Jem Taylor, and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of, Jim and I, elected Henry to be the director initially. But shortly after we started, we recruited Franco to be a part of it. And after a year or so, Henry decided that he didn't want to do it anymore. And so we asked Franco to do it. And he's been the director ever since.
Was this an internal recruit? He was on campus already?
He was. He was a student of Giorgio Margaritondo, who was a physics faculty
mm-hmm.
member.
Yeah, I've heard that name.
And Giorgio brought him to campus as a postdoc, and while he was here as a postdoc, we took an interest in him, and my department hired him as an assistant professor. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that is when we asked him to join the X-ray Lithography mm-hmm. Center, and shortly after he was promoted to associate professor, we asked him to be the director.
He's another one that I should get to sometime.
Oh, you should.
That whole synchrotron group is such an interesting group of people.
It really is.
Let's just tie this up with getting back to Texas for one moment. I assume that Semitech is doing well down there and prospering.
They seem to be, yeah.
So there haven't been any problems as far as you know?
No. It's probably a good choice for them.
Yeah. Let's talk for a little about your next, the next hat that you wore at the university campus. And that's as Associate Dean for Research in the College of Engineering. A position you held from September of 86 until July of 89, almost 3 years. Again, this was a 50% appointment, is that correct?
I believe so.
40-hour a week, 50%?
Yeah, I think it was 50% most of the time. It might have been 75% some of the time. I don't remember for sure.
Let's set the background for this. You can straighten a few things out for me regarding exactly what the experiment station did and exactly when its function changed. It's a little bit like the Materials Center and program. I get a little confused reading the different accounts. But your predecessor, I guess you could call it, would be Camden Coberly.
Right.
And Camden Coberly was the director of the experiment station. And the experiment station was the research. Explain exactly what the experiment station was.
Well, I'm not sure that I completely understand it. You could ask Bollinger sometime. I think it was established under former Dean Marshall.
Mm-hmm. Bob Marshall.
Bob Marshall. And I believe that it was established to be the administrative home of things that didn't fit entirely or comfortably within any one department in engineering. So, for example, it contained a computer center. A couple of big plasma experiments, most of the interdepartmental programs like material science, what else? An instrumentation systems center, which was a service facility that would build equipment for researchers.
Calibration
services. A rheology research lab, a solar energy research lab, and so on. These are things that involved multiple departments and didn't necessarily belong or fit well in mm-hmm. any one department. So they just established this entity called the experiment station, and I think it was an analogy with the ag research farms or agricultural experiment stations. That's why they used that terminology, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And by giving it a name and a budget code, they created an administrative entity.
Mm-hmm.
And Koberly's title was Associate Dean for Research and Director of the Experiment Station.
Was he the original one?
I believe so.
So he had held that position
yeah.
as long as it was there. Now, as chair of the materials science program, you were under the rubric of the experiment
That's
station,
correct.
So you must have worked with Koberly.
That's right, I did. I technically, in my capacity as chair of the material science program and director of the Material Science Center, I reported to Koberly.
Mm-hmm. Just looking back, based on what you know and what you observed, what were Koberly's major accomplishments as director of the experiment station?
Well, I think he was very good at helping people make links with industry and with other units on the campus. He was sort of a bridge builder and encouraged interdisciplinary, interdepartmental work.
Was it a fairly successfully operating entity as far as you were concerned?
I think so, yeah.
Now, every dean, of course, has his own style, and when Marshall left, Bollinger came in, and he did some major restructuring of the experiment station in 1986, a few years after I'm sure he got in there, had a chance to look at things, observe things, and then
yes.
made some changes. Why, in your opinion, did the restructuring take place? Okay, we're talking about the restructuring of the experiment station when Dean Bollinger took over.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what I know about it, let me put that differently. I'll tell you what I believe and have heard about it. I would prefer that you confirm anything that you think is important in this mm-hmm. with John Bollinger himself, because he will know much more accurately. But after I became Associate Dean for Research in the College of Engineering, he told me a fair bit about what he had discovered and what he had had to cope with when he first became Dean. And there were two or three types of generic problems that were associated with the experiment station. One of them was a rather substantial number of industrial research grants that had never been collected from the companies. In other words, the faculty had proposed to a particular company that they would do a certain kind of research. The company approved it, approved the budget, and on the basis of that, the experiment station opened an account with that amount of money in it. Let's say it was $50,000 in a particular case. The faculty member had no reason to believe that there wasn't $50,000 there, and went ahead and committed it and spent it, did the research and wrote a report or whatever. But in fact, the experiment station bureaucracy never got around to sending a bill to the company, so they never really collected the money from the company. They could have, they had every right to, but they just never did. And the company bureaucracies, in many cases, didn't realize that they hadn't been billed yet, and they're not in the habit of paying money when they don't receive a bill for it.
Mm-hmm.
So when Bollinger came in, he discovered quite a number of these. I believe he told me they amounted to almost $1 million in aggregate. Of what by that time, some of them were many, many years old, by that time was essentially uncollectible debts, uncollectible accounts receivable. And he discussed that with the central campus budget office and arranged a sort of a loan from the campus to clear his books up, and then paid it back slowly over the next few years out of indirect cost recovery or other sources of funds. But the college, as he took it over, he discovered was something in the order of magnitude of $1 million in debt. Another issue that actually he and I together sort of figured out and unraveled was the way in which a unit called the Instrumentation Systems Center was being subsidized. That was a center that was very much resented by the faculty in the sense that it had a lot of space that they coveted. It seemed to have an inside track with the administration, and in particular with Camp Coberly, to get whatever they wanted. And we were consistently told that they were a self-financing cost recovery unit that was breaking even, or even making a profit that returned money to the college that could be then reallocated to the departments. Well, in fact, what we found was that a good bit of their revenue that looked like income was money that Coberly allocated to friends and colleagues and faculty members in engineering departments for the purpose of turning around and spending at ISC. So it was an indirect way to subsidize ISC. And that took a while to figure out how it was happening and what was going on. I discovered some of it when I became Coberly's successor, when faculty who had been getting that kind of funding from Coberly would come to me and ask for more money that they could use to spend at ISC. And when I realized the magnitude of all of those expectations out there, I could see that a good chunk of their budget was really this sort of circuitous subsidy. Mm. We phased ISC out completely.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Under your deanship, under your associate deanship. Yeah. And it was because of this kind of.
Well, it was because when you really looked at it in detail, the things that they were doing, although the concept of an ISC made sense in the abstract, this was the concept was that we would develop and nurture on campus. Core of expertise in instrumentation and calibration of instruments and repair of instruments and building customized instrumentation. It seems like the kind of thing you would need. But in fact, what turned out was, in every specific instance that we investigated, it was or would have been cheaper to simply contract that out to the outside private sector than to have ISC do it. It just costs more. Mm-hmm. We were not doing it effectively or efficiently, and so there was no justification for continuing to try to do it internally when we could do it better and more cheaply by just buying the services. So we phased them out.
Was the rest of the faculty pretty much aware of what you have just talked about
no.
in terms of the ISC?
To this day, most faculty don't know that.
Was there resentment in engineering when you shut down the ISC, or did people try to defend it, or was it pretty much seen as
something? Oh, sure. Every change anywhere, especially on campuses, generates cries of alarm. Mm-hmm. And what are we going to do for this kind of service or that kind of service if they're not here anymore? But it was mixed. There were some people who suspected that this was a problem and were just as happy to see them go. I should say that there seemed to be a sort of shadow government of sorts. These are people that Bob Marshall and then Bob together with Cam Coberly and then those two together with their next recruit brought to campus to be the college administration. They included Norm Houston, who was the director of the Instrumentation Systems Center, and Dick Hossman, who was an associate dean, or an assistant dean, I can't remember which, Clayton Smith. These people together were sort of the key decision makers and allocators for the college. And some of the people that I've just mentioned, I believe Cam and Arthur Lodge and maybe Dick Hossman, and there were others, I just can't remember all the names, were brought in to faculty positions, but not in any one department. In those days, it was possible to grant tenured faculty positions in the engineering experiment station. And there
even,
was...
Even though the department that the person might be best suited for might not want them. It would just
right.
be in the experiment
right.
station.
Now, in the end, I believe all those people were phased into departments. Coberly certainly was, and he actually has done quite well in chemical engineering. And Arthur Lodge was a very successful and distinguished faculty member in engineering mechanics. That department no longer exists, but he was in that department for many years, at least half-time. I think he was always half-time or more in the rheology research center, which was a unit of the experiment station. But what I'm pointing out is that there were quite a number of people who were not recruited by or ever housed or tenured entirely within any one department mm-hmm. in the college. There was this experiment station, which was kind of an amorphous, it gave people a kind of amorphous existence within the college. And as near as I can tell, most of the people who were brought in by that route were part of this the ruling party, let's say, in the college.
On board this kind of like a ghost ship almost,
yeah.
Type thing. So is it fair to say that after Bollinger had a chance to look at this, he essentially cleaned house? Was that what the restructuring was all about?
He eliminated the experiment station as an entity, as an administrative entity. He clarified the role of the associate dean to be his associate dean for research and graduate education with no mention of the experiment station.
He clarified
the reporting lines and took all, one of the first things he did was he pulled back into the dean's office, in fact, onto his desk personally, all budget authority in the college to clarify the budgets, and then only very slowly released that back out as he got things under control. I think that was a very smart move on his part.
So he essentially centralized control
yes,
in his office.
In his office.
And your role then, you were the first associate dean for research.
Right.
Correct? Your role differed from Colberly in the sense, first of all, there was no experiment station. Secondly, you weren't dealing with the budget in the way that Colberly was.
Exactly.
And so you were dealing with more of the program
research program issues and managing the staff of the research support services.
Okay.
And I had overall responsibility for the interdisciplinary center still that used to be called the experiment station. They just weren't called that anymore. And a fair degree of latitude and influence in some of the allocations of research support funds within the college. But Bollinger always, in the end, made the final decisions on all budget items.
Why did he choose you, do you think? I'll ask him that question, certainly, but do you have any reason why?
I really don't know.
Based on
I think he felt the material science program had been successful and was a model for interdisciplinary activity and so on. We got along well. I think that was a factor. I really honestly don't know. I don't believe he had a search. I don't think it was a very formal thing. I do remember one day at some meeting or another down at the Edgewater, sitting at the bar at a reception, he asked me if I would do it. And I remember saying that I would think about it, that I really didn't want to get into administration. And running the Material Science Center was plenty enough, and I enjoyed research and teaching and blah, blah, blah. And,
Did he let you in on what the problems were before you became dean, or is that something that you...
No, that's something that took a while to piece together.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you became associate dean, you put together a staff. Who was Clayton Smith? Did he work?
Clayton Smith had reported to Colberly, and I
so
became his new his new boss. I think initially I didn't have any new staff. I just sort of inherited the staff that Colberly had had. We did, after a year or so, get an administrative assistant as a new position. And we moved a few people around and changed some reporting lines and that sort of thing, but nothing major. It wasn't anything dramatic.
So was Clayton's main job with you the same as with Cam? He did a lot of lobbying and stuff and things like that?
The big difference is he no longer had... let me go back to what I said earlier about the financial situation.
Okay.
Bollinger felt that part of the problem had been that Marshall wasn't interested in the details of the budget and so on. He led as a from the bully pulpit of the dean's office, but did not want to do the day-to-day management. He delegated that to Colberly. And Colberly, in turn, delegated a fair bit of latitude and budget authority and so on to other people as well, including Clayton Smith. And Bollinger felt that this process of delegating so many different pieces of the budget to so many different people, almost guaranteed that things would get out of hand and out of control because there was no one person mm-hmm. who was keeping an eye on all of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he pulled it all back to himself. So one of the changes was that, from his point of view, Clayton was stripped of a fair bit mm-hmm. of power and authority that he had had under Coberly and Marshall.
Yeah,
he was a little hurt by that.
I would say so.
Yeah. And I think that's, in some ways, unfair and unfortunate. Clayton is a gem, and he did a wonderful job for the college. He was just ideal for that kind of a job. He did a very good job mentoring new faculty.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that was the strength of his.
Taking them to Washington, introducing them to the agencies, and so on. If he has a weakness, and he does, it's that he's very, very kind and generous. And he always thinks the best of everyone. Mm. He doesn't mistrust anyone, even after they've given him very good reason to mistrust them. And he's always wants to be helpful. Now, if you put those characteristics together with someone who has a lot of budget, control and authority, and very little oversight, it's a prescription for trouble. And that's...
Which is exactly what they got.
Right. Mm.
My... So you assume this new role. Where do you expend your energy? Where are you putting your efforts when you assume the associate deanship? What programs are you developing? What initiatives are you?
I would have to spend some time going back and looking at my annual reports and thinking about that. I really don't remember in detail. I remember some things that occupied a fair bit of my time. One of them was ISC.
Yes.
Another was the Rheology Research Center. Another was anything and everything having to do with space and remodeling. That remains the biggest thorn in my side to this day. Not what happened back then, but it's still a big problem on this campus. And I still spend a lot of time dealing with building, remodeling, and space issues.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
As far as program development is concerned, the thing that we put a lot of time and effort into was getting the departments to get serious about doing their own strategic planning. Bollinger initiated a series of, started the practice of taking all of the chairs and his associate deans on a two-day retreat once a year to a cabin up by Mirror Lake. And those were, I thought, very useful and productive retreats.
And that's something Bollinger started.
Yes.
And who went on this now?
All of the department chairs, key center directors, like the material science chair, mm-hmm. Was treated as if he or she was a department chair. And the associate deans of the college.
And what did you do up there?
Talked about where the college was, where it ought to be, what the challenges were, what the opportunities were, what we should put our emphasis on for the next year, and so on.
Hmm.
I think he's the first person I ever heard use the term strategic plan.
Hmm.
And I remember being quite skeptical because it sounded awfully corporate.
Mm-hmm, sure does.
And, didn't sound like anything that would be very relevant to a university. That's also the way it struck all of the department chairs. So when he ordered the chairs to all go back and develop their strategic plans, they sat with blank looks on their faces and scratched their heads and didn't do it. So the next year, he asked them how their strategic plans were coming, and no one had any idea what to say or anything to show. So he told them again. This time he said, here's how you do it, and here's what I want you to do. Now go do it. Once again, they didn't do it. So the third time, this is after 2 years now, he came to the retreat with a plan that he just sat down and wrote out for the whole college. Mm. He said, this is what we're going to do, and this has the details for your departments and everything. This is our plan. This is where we're going. He gave it to them, and they looked it over and said, like hell it is. We don't like this. And so then they started critiquing it and suggesting modifications, and by the end of the retreat, they had some ownership because they had helped
mm-hmm.
craft it.
Mm-hmm.
Another very clever move.
Had he done that intentionally?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Did he, the term strategic plan, was that just something he came up with? Was it based on some theory of management
I'm sure that it's something that he had learned from serving on corporate boards mm-hmm. and consulting with industry mm-hmm. and so on.
What about industrial consortiums and things like that? Did you work on that a lot in your assessment?
Yeah, I helped quite a number of units form new ones. And I think at one point we had about 12 or 15 of them in the College of Engineering.
And
with various degrees of success and size.
And the research centers as well were something that were they pretty much in place when you took?
Most of them were. Killed some and started some new ones, mm-hmm. but I don't think, I can't say that was the golden era when they all, mm-hmm. Were spawned or anything.
Just for a moment, we're going to talk about this more when we talk about your graduate school career sometime in spring or summer, something like that. But in terms of the nature of research, I remember when I talked to Max, he said, it started out where professors would have a little $5,000 grant with Cutler Hammer or something like that, and there were these little tiny little things, and then things changed dramatically. How do you view the change in funding for research and structure of research in the College of Engineering during your years there? Did you see dramatic changes?
Yes and no. I think most of the changes that occurred are changes that occurred everywhere, mainly because of changes in federal funding priorities. In those days that Max referred to, when people had their individual funding for $50,000 projects and so on, that's the way funding was done from the federal mm-hmm. agencies and everywhere else in those days. The concept of big multi-investigator centers was pretty rare. The other thing I'll say is that when I first came here in 75, there were quite a large number of faculty in the College of Engineering who were hired either before or immediately after World War II, especially mm-hmm. just after World War mm-hmm. II, when all the returning GIs showed up in hordes and we had to dramatically expand the size of the faculty to accommodate all these new students. So they quickly hired a lot of people, mainly to teach hordes mm-hmm. of incoming mm-hmm. students. Mm-hmm. Many of those people didn't have PhDs, were not trained to do research, had no interest in doing research, never intended to do research, didn't think they were hired to do research, okay?
Mm-hmm. Weren't hired to do research.
And were not hired to do research. And so as the nature of university faculty positions, especially in engineering, changed and evolved, and we were hiring more and more people with a clear mission that included mm-hmm. research, they became more and more alienated and felt less part of the mainstream of the college, felt less respected by their new colleagues. I think it's probably because they were mm-hmm. less respected. Mm-hmm. So there was a period there when the college really had two different classes of faculty with very different ideas and expectations about what they were there for.
Mm-hmm.
And most of those faculty were not at all involved in going out and getting grants or doing research or supervising graduate students. So as they retired and were replaced, there was a sudden dramatic increase in the number of faculty who were aggressively mm-hmm. engaged in research. And with that change, there was an enormous increase in federal funding and corporate funding for research and engineering. So you can see a dramatic growth. But I think some of it is due to that natural turnover and change in the nature of the faculty.
That's so true in so many departments and colleges across the campus. You see that post-World War II hiring phase, and mm-hmm. then these people very quickly become the old Turks
right.
and the young Turks with the PhD, and in engineering especially, because a PhD was not something engineers generally had.
Nope.
They just went and worked in industry and then came worked here.
And it was made, actually World War II had a dramatic effect on the nature of engineering education, because if you think about it, maybe no one's ever pointed it out in quite these terms, but the really dramatic breakthroughs that were made during World War II, the Manhattan Project, developing the atomic bomb, understanding nuclear energy, radar, sonar, the Norden bomb sight, proximity fuses. You can just go down the list of all these technological innovations that were almost miraculous. They were all done by physicists, chemists, mathematicians. Engineers hardly played a role. And the reason, so I'm told, I wasn't active in those days. I was born in 42. was that the engineers of that generation were trained to be sort of cookbook engineers. In other words, there were tables and handbooks where you looked things up. You didn't have to understand why it was that way. You just had to know where to look it up. So the engineers were not trained to be creative or curious or research-oriented or investigatory in any way, shape, or form. They were work-for-hire specialists who knew how to look things up and specify the right amount of concrete or the right thickness of steel to get the job done.
Almost like craftsmen. Huh?
Craftsmen, yeah. And they were stunned and shocked and chagrined.
Mortified.
Mortified to find that all of these scientists that that they wouldn't have thought could do a practical thing to save their lives were the ones that saved our bacon in the war effort.
Saved our butts.
And so engineering education after World War II literally went overboard in trying to become...
They were literally teaching.
They were teaching science the way the science departments taught it, and turning out engineers who really had never tried to build anything or put it all together to do something practical. So the engineering accrediting organizations really came down pretty hard on engineering departments to get some practical experience in laboratory work and design work back into the curriculum, which I think by now has been pretty well accomplished.
You must have been developing an administrative style at this point. Could you characterize your administrative style? Can you do that?
Not sure.
I'm not even exactly sure what I mean by that question. It's
well, you know, everybody always asks the question and nobody ever knows what they mean by it. I guess I'd have to say that it's pretty open and participatory. I think probably the best thing any manager or administrator or leader can do is pick really good people and stay out of their way so that they can get things done. I mean, you can't do it all yourself. And if you micromanage them too much, they won't have any motivation to try to do it well themselves the first time. So the most important skill to have is good judgment about people.
So you delegate heavily?
Try to.
Yeah.
Now, there's some kinds of things that I like to do for myself, for better or worse. mostly things having to do with analysis, looking at numerical indicators of how we're doing in various ways and making sense out of them.
Now, you mentioned in our very first meeting, I believe, that you were at the time working on an article related to something along those lines that you were writing. Is that, am I?
We just sent one off to the publisher, and I've got another one about done.
And what are those on?
The first one is on establishing confidence limits for rank ordering anything. So, for example, once every 10 years, the National Research Council rates PhD programs around the country and publishes lists. And they declare that this program is number one in the country, and this one's number two, and so on down to number 200 in the case of a chemistry department, or a number 30 in the case of a comparative literature department or something. Different fields have different numbers of departments in them. What we've done, I've been working with a math postdoc on these two papers. We've addressed that problem both analytically and doing computer simulations to establish confidence limits for those rankings, in the sense that just saying that this program is number 6 out of 30 doesn't tell you much. How close were they to being number 7?
Oh,
or with what confidence can you say that they're really number 6? And that's an oversimplification of what we've done, but But basically, what we've got now is I'm quite confident that we have a way to say that in any particular rank ordering exercise, if you tell me what the scores are and what the error distributions were on the scores, I can tell you that with 90% confidence, this unit is between the 46th and 71st percentile. Mm-hmm. And with 50% confidence, they're between this and that, and so on.
Is this something that you just came up with, or is this something that's a spin-off on what people have been doing?
No, we did this entirely from scratch. We couldn't find it anywhere else. And then we actually got the CD-ROM from the National Research Council that contains all the data for their last study of PhD programs. Hmm. And we took all of their data and reanalyzed it and put up on a website confidence limits for every single program.
Oh my.
Nobody knows it's there yet. Well, we're going to wait until our paper is accepted for publication, and then we do say in the paper that if you want to see how your department looks, go to such and such a web address.
Why will you get the hits?
Yeah. Then the other paper is again mathematical modeling of something. It's modeling how departments change composition, ethnic or gender composition, as a function of time under various assumptions. In other words, it's sort of an analytic model of affirmative action, how it works and doesn't work, and what are realistic and unrealistic expectations.
Interesting.
That one's going to be even more controversial.
Yeah, are you going to have a website for that one, too?
Probably.
I want to close the interview with by looking at the beginning of your next step, which, as I said, we'll talk about down the line a little bit, your deanship in the graduate school. In July of 1989, you were replaced. You were named to replace Robert Bach as dean of the graduate school, and he had been dean for 22 years. How did you become interested in this position? How were you solicited for it? And how did the hire come about?
Well, I don't remember exactly how many, but I think several people nominated me because I got a letter from a committee saying that I had been nominated, and then lots of people told me that they had been the one that nominated me. So I never found out the details, but I was nominated, and I remember once again not wanting to do it, and I talked to, among other people, Jim Taylor. You can gather from these interviews that Jim has been a long-time friend of mine.
Right.
Jim and Max and others.
Mm-hmm.
And so I discussed it with him, and he said, I can understand why you wouldn't want to do it, and I'm not sure I would either, but by all means, you should leave your name in, because if you make it that far, you'll get to talk to the search committee,
mm-hmm.
and you can tell them all the things that we know of that are wrong with the graduate school.
Mm.
And I thought, well, that's probably not bad advice, because in the end, if I don't want to do it, I can always say no anyway. But having a chance to talk to this committee and just unload on them all the things that should be changed in the grad school is a good opportunity. So I did. I stayed in. I did get interviewed by the committee, and I remember this quite clearly. I really did a dump on them about all the things that were wrong with the grad school, because I felt, you know, what the hell, I have no stake in this.
Yeah.
I don't care whether I get it or not. I don't want it particularly.
And they said, whip me some more, is that it?
And I do remember at one point the student said, why are you interested in this job? And I said, well, I'm not really. I just wanted to tell you what I think about the graduate school. And he said, what could we say that would make you take an interest in it? And I said, can't think of anything. And that was the end of the interview. And I really don't know what they recommended to Chancellor Shalala. I may or may not have been their first choice. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have any way of knowing, and don't particularly care. But at some point, she came to me and said, would you be interested in doing this? I'd like to ask you to do it, if you will. And she's the one who really twisted my arm.
Mm-hmm.
I gave her all the reasons why I didn't want to do it, mm-hmm. and for every one of them, she had a better reason mm-hmm. why I should, or why, rather than being an obstacle, it was an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And she eventually convinced me to do it. And she asked me in the end, are there any conditions that you would like to put on this? Any things that you would have to have if you did it? And I said, only one that I can think of. I really don't want to have anything to do with athletics. I realize that people in central campus administrative positions might have some role in the athletic programs. I don't want to know about it. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to go to the games. I don't want anything to do with it. And when she stopped laughing, she shook hands and said, that's a deal.
End of interview.